It recognizes gallantry that goes above and beyond the call of duty in the face of an enemy attack. The tradition awarding this honor began during the Civil War, and many of those who have received the medal have given their lives in the action that earned it. Today we add Lieutenant Michael Murphy's name to the list of recipients who have made the ultimate sacrifice. Deep in the mountains of Afghanistan, this brave officer gave his life in defense of his fellow Navy SEALs. 2 years later, the story of his sacrifice humbles and inspires all who hear it. And by presenting Michael Murphy's family with the Medal of Honor that he earned, a grateful nation remembers the courage of this proud Navy SEAL. I appreciate the fact that we've got Barney Barnum, Tom Kelly, Tommy Norris, and Mike Thornton, Medal of Honor recipients, with us today. We do welcome Dan Murphy and Maureen Murphy, father and mother of Michael Murphy, John Murphy, his brother, and other family members that are with us today. It's my honor to welcome all the friends and comrades of Lieutenant Michael Murphy here to the White House. Michael's decision to join the military wasn't an easy one for his family. As a Purple Heart recipient during Vietnam, Michael's father understood the sacrifices that accompany a life of service. Fewer than a third of those who begin this intense training program graduate to become Navy SEALs. There was little doubt about the determined lieutenant from New York. In 2002, Michael earned his Navy SEAL Trident. They remember a patriot who wore a New York City firehouse patch on his uniform in honor of the heroes of 9/11. And they remember an officer who respected their opinions and led them with an understated yet unmistakable sense of command. Together, Michael and his fellow SEALs deployed multiple times around the world in the war against the extremists and radicals. While their missions were often carried out in secrecy, their love of country and devotion to each other was always clear. On June 28, 2005, Michael would give his life for these ideals. While conducting surveillance on a mountain ridge in Afghanistan, he and three fellow SEALs were surrounded by a much larger enemy force. Their only escape was down the side of a mountain, and the SEALs launched a valiant counterattack while cascading from cliff to cliff. But as the enemy closed in, Michael recognized that the survival of his men depended on calling back to the base for reinforcements. With complete disregard for his own life, he moved into a clearing where his phone would get reception. He made the call, and Michael then fell under heavy fire. Yet his grace and upbringing never deserted him. Though severely wounded, he said thank you before hanging up and returned to the fight before losing his life.
GlobalRecon.net, giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. Back on co-hosting with me is Chantel Taylor, former British Army combat medic and author of the book Battle Worn. Chantel, how you been?
Hey, good. I'm glad to be back. It's been busy.
Yeah, it felt weird without you on here.
Did you miss me, John? Is that what you're saying? Publicly said you...
Yeah, so back on the podcast with us is former U.S. Navy SEAL and author of the best-selling book, The Last Punisher, Kevin Lace. Kevin, what's up, brother?
John, Chantel, good to have me on. Doing all right down here.
It's funny enough, Kevin, because you've been on a podcast before, but for someone who's already been on the podcast, I've gotten so many emails from different people asking to get you on the podcast. And I'm like, did people just like miss that or?
No, actually, I'd pay all those people to email you so to get me back on.
But I think sometimes there's more to cover. Like they probably had questions, you know, where you, because you can't discuss everything and, you know, time
Yeah, it was just weird. Like, you know, so sometimes people email and say, oh, you know, this might be an interesting topic or this person might be interesting to cover. And I'm reading it. I'm like, oh, yeah, this guy Kevin Lace would be cool. I'm like, oh, yeah, I had him on the podcast. And then I just keep getting these emails from different people. Kind of interesting.
Well, I'm honored. I'm honored. Definitely. You know, we've received a lot of support from the book. And, you know, Lindsay and I have been around the country and, you know, and sometimes been around the world, you know, promoting the book. So we've met a lot of cool people and the stories have definitely stuck with us and we're, you know, happy to share.
You know, these books are important for several reasons, but one for, you know, people to kind of know what's going on in these war zones and what guys like yourself are going through in a real and emotional way. And then on top of that, what I feel is one of the most important points or takeaways from these books is that they inspire the next generation of warriors, you know? And I think you can't put you can't quantify how important that is, you know?
I agree. You know, it's interesting you say that because I was talking to somebody in Chicago yesterday and they were mentioning how, you know, they were asking about Syria and what's going on. And they're like, I really don't feel like I can believe the news these days. And I was like, I think you're about right. And, you know, the books lend, you know, a deeper look into the situations, the operations and the people that are, you know, telling those stories. And he asked me, like, where do you think the truest information is coming from some of these areas? And, you know, quite frankly, it's either on YouTube or some of these Instagram, you know, accounts, because those people are just uploading from what's going on and it's not filtered by mainstream media.
Right. Absolutely right. And it's, you know, this new battlefield is so different from any of the past because it started in Vietnam where you had, you know, kind of live reporting from the war zone. And then now you have, and that's coming from a certain source, you know, one or two outlets or whatever it might be. But now with social media and everything, you're getting videos from battles and stuff like that that have just taken place and there's no filter on them. So you kind of get a look into what's happening in some areas. And it's really quite incredible.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose at some sort of stage, when news outlets get hold of them, they can tend to, and what we've seen, you know, definitely here in the UK, is they swing it to their own affiliation. So whatever sort of, especially politically, which whoever they're kind of behind, that's the, do you know what I mean? They always seem to spin it in a different way. But you're right about these forms of social media. They get the story out there. Sometimes it's a bad thing, but for the majority of the time, at least you get some sort of ground truth by, you know, physically seeing it or hearing it from guys on the ground.
Sure.
Absolutely. So, Kevin, so before we jump into some of the stuff we're going to talk about, can you just give a quick background, you know, from your time in the Navy?
Sure. You know, I joined the Navy. I grew up in a family who always supported the military, but you know, I had an event in my life, you know, just about everybody over this age of 16 had the same event. It was 9/11 that changed my perspective and really the direction that I was going. I wasn't a very outstanding college student, but the terrorist attacks, you know, hit close to home, had a family friend who was killed in the Trade Center and kind of prompted me to enlist in the Navy, you know, with the intention of becoming a SEAL by all means, no guarantees. But I kind of took the, you know, situation I was in and turned it more into a positive by, you know, striking out on my own and going to BUDS. I graduated in class 246. From there, you know, I did the SEAL qualification training, jump school. I did the 18 Delta program, became a combat medic and landed at SEAL Team 3 right in the 2005 timeframe and worked up for my first deployment, which was in Ramadi 2006. By the time we deployed, I'd gone to sniper school. So I was a sniper and a medic. And, you know, cut my teeth in one of the more memorable battles of Western Iraq, which was Ramadi pre-surge in 2006, deployed again with, you know, some guys that are now household names like Mike Mansour, Mark Lee, Ryan Jobe, Chris Kyle. And we did a lot of good things with the Army, the Air Force, and the Marines in Ramadi that helped, you know, set the stage for the surge of 2007. I deployed again in 2008 to the western edge of Iraq on the Syrian border and spent 6 months out there doing about the same. Got out in 2010, went back to school, at the University of Connecticut and then grad school and became a physician assistant. And now I'm a physician assistant here in Florida, in addition to a co-author of a best-selling book, The Last Punisher, with my wife and Ethan Rock. He's a former Marine combat correspondent, and we detail that battle of Ramadi to help tell that complete story of, you know, not only the SEAL teams, but the work of the Army and the Air Force and the Marines.
An interesting book, because I mean, there's been literature out before that, but obviously Chris Kyle, when he put out his book, he details some of that, and it just gave you an insight to what was going on there, and you know, what Americans were facing and what Iraqis were facing with the insurgency and some of those foreign terrorist groups who were operating there. So by the time you came in, you were finished with your, you know, you went through BUDS, you went through your qualification training, and then when you got to your SEAL platoon, they had just gotten back from a deployment, right?
Correct. Yeah, SEAL Team 3 had come back from, you know, a bunch of guys out PACOM, and then the guys from Iraq started rotating back, and you know, they were spread out throughout the countryside. You know, some were down in Baghdad, and others were up, you know, in the Battle of Fallujah. And some of them particularly were a lot of the guys who brought a lot of knowledge to my first deployment, their second one to Iraq, which was Ramadi. And guys like Chris, you know, Chris Kyle started, developing that sniper doctrine that we together perfected, you know, the SEAL Team 3 Task Unit Bruiser did in 2006, which was using special forces snipers in conjunction with conventional troops to help, you know, deter enemy movement, enemy, IED emplacements, and then a lot of coordinated attacks. So,
Kevin, on just before you go forward of that, I found that really interesting that he developed that. Because that's kind of unseen, to have a special forces unit actually go in. You know, do you know what I mean? It was quite an interesting thing. How did that come about? You know, who?
So, you know, the whole idea of special forces is simply to be force multipliers in unconventional warfare. And, the Battle of Ramadi differed from Fallujah. Fallujah was simply cordon off or block off the city. You know, tell the women and children to leave, and then the men are going to go ahead and fight it out. It's Al-Qaeda versus coalition. And that had a lot of negative ramifications politically, socially, for how that battle was portrayed. You know, Ramadi was more of a clear hold and build. So it would be a softer approach to stomping out the enemy. And this is where special forces were utilized side by side with conventionals without having to kick the women and children out, but to move block by block, road by road. And we did this as a team through primarily sniper overwatches. And it had been done in the past, but not on such a big scale, to the best of my knowledge. And since Ramadi was, you know, that area where a lot of foreign fighters were coming, a lot of people wanted to fight coalition, it made it a very target-rich environment. So, the steam that all of us started generating as, you know, more and more targets hit the ground, that helped, you know, really turn the tide in Western Iraq.
Yeah, so I mean, it's quite an amazing concept, actually, and the kind of the success that you had there speaks for the idea working.
Yeah, and you know, prior to that, there's always been that people see as special forces just, you know, hang, especially SEALs, you know, it's like they just sit and wait for that mission to prime and then they go. Some units do that, and that's what they're supposed to do. And I'm not taking anything away from them. And the missions they've done are pretty incredible, and the results, you know, have yielded a ton of information. Really bad guys have hit the ground. But where we were used as more of a quasi-special forces group, and we worked quite a bit with the conventionals. And I think that, you know, one, kind of broke down a lot of preconceptions people had about SEALs. And, you know, we found that we meshed well with the Marines and the Army, and, you know, we were able to systematically go through that city together and really root out that insurgency.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's an interesting way to utilize, you know, special operations forces, particularly snipers. When you first got to your platoon, and you know, you met Chris Kyle and all these guys, and you were the new guy, was Chris already a sniper at that point, or did he go to sniper school after that?
Yes, Chris was a sniper prior to. He, I think he had 19 confirmed kills and 18 or 19 confirmed kills in Fallujah, which at that time was, you know, quite a bit, especially for, you know, a West Coast team guy. And that's when he started gaining a lot of the notoriety within the community. And, you know, Chris was a an unconventional guy with wisdom. You know, I always make the analogy, you know, have you ever met somebody on your team that knows everything? And, you know, you get a lot of chuckles when you ask that question, and people kind of infer like, well, Chris knew everything. Chris knew a lot about being a sniper, but he had the ability to teach people about being a sniper. And I don't mean, you know, how to put a reticle on a target and squeeze a trigger, but more so how to conduct yourself as a sniper. And I think there's a lot of power given to somebody behind a gun, particularly a sniper in a target rich environment. And then there's also the negative impacts you can have if you are not careful or, you know, over aggressive, and can really be more of a detriment to your unit and the cause in which you're fighting. And I think Chris helped, you know, really articulate that to young snipers like myself. You know, people in the platoon, you know, my other medic was a sniper as well, and guys that had not been in combat situations like Chris. And Chris was a guy who knew everything, but was willing to communicate to new snipers to get people up to speed to a war that, you know, he had experienced and we were just stepping forth into for the first time.
Right, right.
And just when you say, Kevin, about, obviously you're talking about medics as well as snipers, and clearly you've gone through your SEAL training, so you're all sort of shooters first. But I always get asked the question of having had to engage like an enemy fighter before, and they always bring up the question, but, you know, but you're a medic. And I always make the point of, but the word combat comes before medic, you know, and it's trying to explain that to people who aren't military savvy or aren't in the military. They find it very hard to understand. And obviously you're in 18 Delta, but you're also a sniper, so you're almost like the two, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum. Do you get asked that? How does anyone actually, because they ask it a lot in my country.
Yeah, all the time. I remember being in Navy boot camp, and, you know, people are like, well, but you're a hospital corpsman and you want to be a SEAL. Like, what does that even mean? And I attribute that to exactly what we talked about earlier is, you know, where people get their sources of information. You know, when you watch a World War II, you know, war movie, you see a medic with the cross, you know, running up to battle without a gun. Yeah. You know, Hacksaw Ridge, movies like that, and people form their opinion of what medics do. And it's true, you know, in some wars, that's exactly what medics did. They were non-combatants. But as we saw more and more, you know, conventional wars go to the wayside, and we fight more guerrilla wars, unconventional wars with insurgencies, you know, they don't adhere to the Geneva Convention. So, you know, the role of combat medic has evolved, that a combat medic is first a part of that team. As a, you know, aggressor force, but he still has a skill set. He or she has a skill set, you know, in reserve to utilize. And that's the way it's gone. And, you know, I always ask the question when people say, well, what do you do when one of your buddies gets shot? And they're like, well, you drop down and you, you know, start applying, you know, pressure or whatever. And I'm like, no, you shoot back, because fire superiority and suppressing, you know, the enemy is step number one for effective hemorrhage control. And, I think it's important when people read these books or they listen to these podcasts, they learn how medics operate. And as a team guy medic, you know, I was a shooter first and I was a medic second.
Yeah, definitely. And that, again, that's the point I always try and make, is that, you know, the word combat comes first. So you could even just look at that. And that's when I joined the military, I chose that job. But yeah, you're exactly right. That it's good to, the stuff that we've all been involved in has kind of brought that to the forefront, and it's so important now that medics are trained far better tactically. You know, that's it's something that we've taken away, so especially as the Brits have taken that away, and the trainings change accordingly. So it's a positive, I guess.
I agree.
Yeah, so, Kevin, in your book, you know, you mentioned Lieutenant Colonel Grossman, who is the author of the book On Killing, which I read. Chantel, I'm not sure if you read it or you're familiar with it, but he basically, in a kind of breaking it down quickly, he studied the psychology of killing, and he went through different wars and talked about how the psychology changed and how the training changed in order to bring up the effectiveness of the warfighter. And, you know, killing different people, and this is something else he talked about, was like, it affects people differently. Some people, even in special operations units, some guys, you know, they might get their first kill and then kind of be repulsed by it. And you know, they say, this is not for me. And then some people are able to do it, are able to kill an enemy in combat and continue to deploy and continue to fight and do what they have to do. So did you read that book before you wrote your book, or did that happen afterwards?
I did. I listened to Lieutenant Colonel Grossman speak twice before each of my deployments, and I read On Killing, you know, prior to my first deployment, and then I read his second book, On Combat, shortly after. And it definitely made a mark on me as kind of a, in the back of my mind, what type of group do I find myself in? And, you know, at the end of that first deployment, I was like, okay, I guess I fall in that, 2% crowd that can go ahead and conduct business and keep going without the, psychological, physiological, changes that, are experienced by most. And that, having gone through that, really was one of the themes that we wanted to, infuse into the book. And, I get a lot of people who pick up on that because they're like, we don't really hear that when we read, a memoir, or we hear a war book, is, how did that affect you? Because it's kind of like, I hear it that people write that I'm just a tough guy and I just push through it, but there's no, psychological approach to having gone through that combat and those experiences and how it affects you and how it sits with you and how you sleep at night in those scenarios. So I wanted to bring that to the forefront because it's important to read, how you put your feet in front of you when you're walking down the street, but also, what you're thinking when you're about to squeeze a trigger and you've got somebody in the crosshairs. And then also the 10, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 10 minutes, or even, 3 years later, how you react to that situation, because I think that's what, drives people to dig deeper and read more and listen to more of these is, what makes that person tick and why are they like that? And am I like that? And how do I relate to it without having to go to combat or, go through buds and be a team guy? So we wanted that to be a theme. And, Grossman's book really resonated with me. And Lindsay and I put a pen to paper with Ethan and made that an essential theme.
Right. And Chantel actually, Chantel has a couple of deployments. She's been a couple of different places, but she was in Afghanistan, and in her book, she talks about this in detail where, they were ambushed and she engaged and killed an enemy fighter. And actually Chantel is renowned as the first female in British military history to do so. Chantel, can we talk about some of that? Like what was going through your mind at the time and how you felt before and after?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to say, actually, I think on Kevin's point that it's always important to respect what you're doing. I always thought from kind of from the get-go that I always would respect, where I was, who I was with, what, why I was there kind of thing, as opposed to just being a bum on a seat, just sort of turning up and not really understanding what was going on around me. But again, right. I deal with things like that. It's important to respect. So say, Kevin's a sniper, and then he obviously respects what that weapon can do and all of those sorts of things. So I think the psychology behind that is actually really important, because a lot of the times people would think, that kind of, you have those moments of that fuck yeah scenario, but it tends not to be when people think it comes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, people don't run around acting that way. But anyway, but back to your question. I was talking about this the other day because I was interviewed for an upcoming article. And again, it's one of those things. It was quite a while ago, and I just sort of put it down to, again, having the training that I had, and I was kind of grateful to be in a position to fight back, because it wasn't. I'm not saying that it wasn't really the. I'm trying to think of the way to put it correctly, but that sounded like a douchebag. Like it didn't really feel like anything, because it was what was meant to happen. Does that make sense? Like I couldn't kind of say at that moment in time I felt anything, because it was kind of like that was just, it was a, an event that unfolded, and there was no choice given. It was, well, the only choice was I was either going to get shot, or obviously take the enemy fighter down. And then I laughed, because a lot of people, they say, because it took me seven rounds to take this guy down, but I was actually firing 5.56. So a lot of people said, "Oh, you're just wasting ammo." And I was like, "Well, actually, that's not that many rounds considering the sort of scenario, the engage, you know, where you are on the battlefield. It doesn't, you just keep firing until someone drops. It's not a case of, I'm not a sniper, but it's kind of, it happened very quickly." But
I think you're 100% correct. And I think this is what, you know, baffles a lot of people when they ask, and I put it sometimes, silly questions about an engagement or why you do things. And the fact of the matter is, most people have never been outside of their comfort zone. You know, the comforts of social media, the comforts of their home, the comforts of their, you know, lily lifestyle. And, you know, they've never experienced a situation where a fight goes bad and you default to a primitive instinct. And you're absolutely right. You know, it's not like you feel exhilarated. It's simply you got the job done, because of that split second. It's either they go home or I go home. And, you know very well that you're going to go home, and that's where you default to primitive, and you shoot until that threat is extinguished, and then you scan and you move for the next one, because that is how a warrior is. And I think a lot of people are perplexed by that, you know, that thought process. And that's why they listen and they read and they try and understand. But we try to make that sense of the book, and also kind of draw a difference between a primitive engagement where, you know, you have a fight gone bad, compared to a sniper where you're more of a voyeur, where you are watching somebody who is walking with a gun, who is very much alive, but you know, and they don't, that in about 3 seconds, they're going to be very much dead. And there's a lot of things that go through your mind, mental checklist that you have to hit before you pull that trigger and squeeze and extinguish that life form. And, you know, it's not an easy process. It doesn't happen it can happen fast, but a lot of the times it's slow moving, it progresses, and you have to be ready for it, because, you know, those imprints in your mind can stick unless you have a clear conscience and you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly how you feel, isn't it? You just kind of, I always look at it this way, is that, you know, I was part of OC's TAC, which is, you know, I had the officer commanding, my company commander, his driver, the radio operators, you know, an Afghan interpreter with me. And I think, well, if I hadn't have done what I did, you know, who's to say one of us was going to be going home? And I find it far easier to live with what I did than to live with being that person that couldn't really come up to the mark, you know, couldn't sort of follow through and do what they'd sort of been trained to do. And then, you know, and those sorts of things are like fleeting moments, because within sort of 30 seconds, we've taken a casualty. And then, you know, aside of other guys were sort of engaging other threats, then I was clear to get involved with the casualty treatment. So things do happen quickly. And I guess at that moment in time, you know, cemented my relationship with the company that I supported. So then when we went on and had, you know, so many casualties, they trusted what I had to do and say. So that it made my life a lot easier on the battlefield. And then things got kind of, let's say, you know, the deployment became, I'm not saying easier as in the deployment was easier, my relationship with the guys on the ground became a lot easier.
I agree. And I think your comfortability with yourself also was a lot greater. And I think that, you know, kind of is a life lesson, you know, you don't have to engage somebody in combat to, you know, become more comfortable with yourself. But when you have these life experiences, whether it's a fight or whether it's you are in combat, you know, you learn a lot more about yourself that you had previously not known. I think that speaks volumes to the people that have been in combat and have gone through those experiences.
Yeah. And you know, just, I'll add one more thing. I was asked a question in this recent interview, and it was about, basically, was I treated different as a woman? And I said, you know what? I said, I served with the 16 Air Assault Brigade, which is quite a ferocious brigade in the British military. And everyone who arrives there has to prove themselves, regardless of whether you're a man or a woman. And that's what I take from that. It didn't make any odds. You know, if I was a guy and didn't carry out that same thing, it would have been exactly the same outcome. So it was just quite an interesting question to be asked, where I thought, well, actually, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, you going on team, even though you've just passed buds, you've still got to prove yourself.
And that's the beauty of the military. It's a meritocracy. You're based on your performance, not your not who you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and that's an interesting point to bring up, because that's also a point that Kevin touched on in his book, you know, being a new guy as a sniper and kind of having to go through that process where you win the respect of your teammates. And Kevin, what was that like for you?
You know, it was, I guess it was about damn time. You know what I mean? Because you go, you know, being a new guy in a platoon is, it's like being, you know, a brand new guy in a fraternity. I can imagine. I was never in a fraternity, or, you know, a new guy on a rugby team. You know, you're given like three tasks. It's like, have a pen and paper, you know, shut the fuck up, be seen, not heard. And, you go about these, you know, bottom of the barrel jobs, you know, loading pallets, breaking down ammo cases, and just doing the worst of the worst. And then you're expected, you know, to perform at the highest level because you're a team guy. And you do that because you want to be that guy that can instill that, you know, pain onto the next group of new guys. But, you know, I think like Chantel put it, you know, the way the deployment happened, and it started happening fast, that, oh, wow, new guy get a kill. And then after a while, you know, well, new guys are killing people just like everybody else, and it becomes commonplace. So I don't think it was that much of a hurdle. I was happy that, you know, it gotten to the point where, you know, started executing and doing my job. But then again, you know, we had superb, you know, enlisted leadership who, you know, kept us in check and didn't let you get too big for your britches too early on. And I think that's what you know, made us new guys very effective.
And you sometimes find, you know, you're talking about those sort of the crappy tasks, like the breaking down of ammo and the pallet stuff. I used to sometimes get to a point where, you know, the responsibility got that great and it was a great thing, but I'd give anything to be back doing that shit job. Do you know what I mean? Isn't it? It was like, oh God, because you kind of, it gave you a little bit of respite in some ways. You know,
you didn't have to think too hard. it got monotonous. But yeah, I mean, there's, and
you just go to bong mode, couldn't you?
Exactly. And you build, I mean, you build such deep bonds with the people who share in that, you know, that sacrifice. And, you know, the new guys we had with, you know, Big Holes and Mark Lee and Johnny, and Jason, you know, us enlisted new guys, you know, we're very strong together. And I think, you know, that's what, I mean, that's what you carry on long after that deployment's gone and, you know, those jobs have passed. It's like, you know, under that sweat and shit, you know, you make some true friends.
Yeah, because it's those experiences that you share and you all kind of, you know, that kind of feeling. It's a good thing. You know, many of my friends now are all, I serve with most of them.
Right. So, Kevin, you're, you know, when you got in your first deployment, and I believe you talked about this in your book, your first time engaging an enemy was behind the sniper rifle?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, the first time, I was out in at Corregidor, which was the army base on the other side of the city, and you know, we were in obviously a hostile area, and there's a lot of enemy activity not too far outside the wire. So, you know, any chance we could get to, you know, get that first opportunity, you know, we took it. And mine happened to be up in a guard tower, you know, just in between little after chow to just kill some time because I didn't have anything else to do. And went up there, and I was up there with a couple army guys, and it was behind the gun. And, you know, it happened a lot faster than I guess I had anticipated before. But based where we were at in that guard tower, you know, guys were moving quick in and out of those buildings and across those little alleyways. But it kind of surprised me at how quick it happened. And then, you know, kind of how quick, you know, you go back to normalcy, almost like the first time you catch a wave and stand up on a surfboard, and then, you know, next thing you know, it's no big deal. But I was amazed at how unshocked I was with how I felt, because I felt like, you know, we're not a lawnmower that cuts every single piece of grass. We're, you know, very precise surgical element that takes out one or two people here or there. But I felt that after that time I interdicted that target, that yes, I feel like I'm in that 2%. And then it was reinforced throughout that deployment.
And so just quickly, you know, kind of building on the 2% aspect of it, would you say that it's important for a new guy going to war, or a platoon with, you know, a couple of new guys and then some guys who have the experience, is it important for them to understand some of that psychology that is taught in On Killing? And then obviously, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman goes and speaks. Do you think that that's important for developing the right mindset for a special operations guy who's going to be deploying to war over a number of years?
I think it's important to start earlier. I think it's important, you know, to read that stuff before you join the military. And I think there was a big push back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where, you know, join the military, go to college. And then, oh no, 9/11 happens. We're in Afghanistan, and then we go in Iraq, and then we're all across the globe. And, you know, you're doing 18-month, you know, stopgap deployments, and you might have to kill people. And I think it catches people off guard. And I think first and foremost, you know, as a individual who wants to be in the military, you know, you're always at the mercy of the military. You're going to go the needs of the Navy, the needs of the Army, to fill gaps. And, you know, you may be in combat. That's why, you know, most of us, you know, should know that's why we joined the military. So I think it's good to know and read about that stuff, because when you're put in that situation, if, you know, for some reason, you know, that's not for you, you know, it's not as a complete shock. You know, it doesn't happen for everybody. You know, that 2%, but, you know, it's something at least to have as a baseline for your basic knowledge.
Right. And Chantel, is this book on killing, is this something that you're familiar with or that you've read before?
Yeah, no, when you talk about Colonel Grossman, is that?
Yeah.
When you started talking about it, I realized who it was. Yeah. And things like that are extremely important. I think, again, if they're not read pre-military, they should at least be, he should be kind of a fixture during people's basic training, you know, whether it's through quotation or through, they should know who he is, you know, especially, and I suppose likewise for someone not dissimilar to him in the UK. But I think those sorts of lessons, it's no good learning them afterwards, is it? Because you could be in a whole right. sort of world hurt, and someone trying to explain that to you afterwards is kind of a bit late. But right. yeah, but you know, through memoirs, through people's blogs, experiences, so long as people aren't giving away the crazy information, which is, you know, and by and large, people are quite good with that, because most books nowadays have to be cleared through the military. So, I think it's no bad thing. I was just laughing and appreciating how John likes the old long silent pauses. let's have another awkward silence. Yeah. Hopefully it's after I start stop speaking.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's funny, you know, the you mentioned giving away the secrets and stuff, you yeah. know, I mean, my book went through the DOD pretty quick, you know, I think it was like maybe, you know, a couple months. Yeah. So some people's take longer, a year, you know, years or so, but yeah. you know, we're talking about like filtered and unfiltered media. I mean, you can go on social media, you can go on sure. YouTube, and you can find tactics, you know, you don't have to look very hard. And I think that's kind of the funny thing about some of these books is, like, you know, there's kind of that suppression. Like, I don't want you to give away tactics, but, you know, heck, you don't have to look very hard to find that, unfortunately, because of social media.
Yeah, right. It's just it's about, you know, let's face facts, with all the way weapons are going, the way people are developing, you know, I think it's a good thing, but sort of tactics, although they keep the basics the same, you know, then people's ability to maneuver is far better, isn't it? With the kit and equipment available now, so
I agree. But I think, you know, I mean, there's tactics, there's going into rooms, and then there's this sheer putting the fear into the minds of the enemy. And, you know, one of the things that we did very well, you know, 350 times, which was interdict people with, you know, sniper rounds in a 6-month yeah. period. And when you see the capabilities of U.S. snipers, and, you know, I can admit I'm not the best shot in the world. A lot of our snipers were not the best shots in the world, but we had a lot of opportunity. But to see how snipers have become so effective, heck, I just read in the news yesterday that some, you know, Canadian sniper hit somebody from like 3,000 meters.
I posted that,
And as long as the enemy knows that there's a really good marksman, you know, somewhere out there, that's going to make them, you know, operate in fear, or at least in some part of the brain, they're going to know that somebody's out there. And I think...
And it gives the troops on the ground. I remember... We used to get such a morale boost and a confidence boost from having our, you know, snipers positioned in certain places. And it didn't lull you into a false sense of security. You just knew that those guys had things covered. You know, they weren't there to mess around. And it just makes such a difference to the morale of the blokes on the ground. And it's just like when the Apache turns up, everyone's like, oh, thank God for that. You know.
Right. We had the same thing, you know, when we get shot out in the streets and the armor would show up, you know, the Marines would come with their tanks or Army would come with their tanks and their you know, Bradleys and that, yeah, it's a sense of security. And I think the same applies for snipers up on rooftops or in the hillside.
And everyone wants to be one.
It's true.
Yeah, it's interesting, kind of the history of snipers, at least in the American side, from in regards to how they're employed and the understanding of the commanders who are employing them, you know, what their skill sets are and how they can be best used. And what's interesting about Ramadi and your experiences there and the experiences of all the Marines, Army soldiers and the SEALs who were there is the kind of the interoperability of the different services, which is really underrated in kind of what people would imagine, you know, executing a war is like. And what's also interesting, Kevin, about some of the going to sniper school and whatnot is different slots are open up for different sniper schools. And if I'm not mistaken, special operations guys have the choice to go to a different sniper school from a different branch, right?
Correct. Yeah. You know, it's like I said, the needs of the Navy. I had a Army sniper school spot open up for me and I went to Army sniper, you know, Fort Benning. I did that course and, you know, I went on used a different platform than the gun I ended up using in the SEAL teams. But I think the skill set still, you know, it still parallels. And, you know, you mentioned the interoperability of different units. I went to sniper school with a couple Army snipers and then lo and behold, you know, 2 years later, we're, you know, in the talk and ready to do a commander's brief on our op. And two of the Army snipers I went to school with, you know, showed up and they helped supplement, you know, our team. So, you know, the military is small. The sniper group's even smaller. But the power of, you know, employing snipers on a battlefield really does change the dynamic and the capacity, like I said, the force multiplying capacity of conventional troops. And I think the way that the, you know, task force leadership employed special ops, particularly the SEAL team in Ramadi, you know, we didn't do anything different than anybody else, but we were able to bring a different dynamic and help, you know, make that coalition force just a little bit bigger with our sniper capabilities.
And it's pretty impressive when I think of some of those sort of hardcore American commanders out there, and you know, they are quite like the ones that are quite the mavericks. You know, they do try different things, and they're not scared to. And obviously, that decision there paid off massively. It's quite to have the sort of the balls to make those decisions. Say, you know, we're going to do it, and.
Yeah, complacency kills on the battlefield, and I think the more you know, you're on your edge and you change tactics and you shift tactics and keep the enemy on their heels, you know, the more dynamic you will be, and then, you know, the more at a disadvantage the enemy will be. And fortunately, you know, the different groups, the Marines and the Army, were willing to accommodate us and, you know, use us, and a lot of the times they're like, you know, have at it. And that's where our enlisted leadership stepped up, like Tony and Chris, and looking for areas we could move to and how we could be gainfully employed and help, you know, protect our Army Marine brother and sisters.
And I know, like, you've been asked this like a million times. What was it like making that film? Because it was, you know, it was a brilliant film.
Megan Sniper. People always like, was it like being in Ramadi? Yeah, I was like, yeah, until they say cut, and then you're like, hey, can I get a bottle of water? And somebody run up with a bottle of water. It was interesting, you know. You and me and, you know, everybody's part of this, you know, has an idea of how we see combat, and especially those that have been there are such a small group. And you want to hold on to this memory and like make sure you get it right. And you're like, this is how combat really is. And then you go to a movie and you're like, ah, that's not how combat is. So as a technical advisor and acting in the movie, watching, you know, Clint and Bradley and, you know, the writer and how they, you know, interpreted. And that's important to say how they interpreted combat and how they brought it to the big screen. You know, it was not exactly how it happens. You know, that's the movie business. So being on set, it's a personal story. So it's tough to see some things, you know, get taken out and other things be added that weren't, you know, absolutely correct. But you have to go for the overall intention. It was an artistic representation of Chris and the SEAL teams. And, you know, being a part of that was special, being a part of it and help tell the story of, you know, team guys and the Army and the Marines was huge. And the outpouring of support since the movie came out has been even greater. And I'm appreciative of that.
And even like for someone like me and obviously people in the UK, just seeing the sort of response to the likes of you and Chris Kyle, I think it's amazing. You know, you really get people get behind their guys and their troops. And I just think it's something that I'm not saying, you know, people are really nice here about it, but there's a marked difference of how, you know, like what the way Texas, you know, treats his memory and stuff, and the way his wife's taken in, and it's something to, I think that people, you know, people should be proud of the way that they treat their veterans.
Yeah, I can speak for Americans. If you watch that opening scene of Patton, you know, Patton puts it correctly. He's like, America loves winners, and you know, I think Chris was a prime example of that. And you know, being a son of Texas, you know, Texas has definitely embraced him. But just to see. And I speak quite a bit around the country, and I always ask people, you know, who hasn't seen American Sniper? And, you know, you might get one or two hands going up, and just about everybody has.
Yeah.
And it's that story of Chris and, you know, primarily American exceptionalism. And I think that resonated with a bunch of people, and, you know, it still does to this day. And he's become a household name.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's a good thing.
And I think it's, you know, it's a good thing, obviously, that to have the support of the people for soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines. And I think, you know, looking back at like Vietnam, for example, you know, after 68, the military lost the support, not all the, you know, all the support, but a large majority of the public was really against the military. And a good friend of mine, Tim Kozak, he's an Army veteran, and he is the creator of the Veterans Project, where they, you know, he follows a veteran for a day, takes some really good photos, and they get a nice story out of that veteran, and they focus on the transitional process. But the reason I bring up Tim is because when he was finishing up his degree, he's from Texas as well, his professor kind of pushed him in the direction of doing this. And part of her motivation for doing that was because she told him that she was protesting the Vietnam War, and she felt really bad about it, looking back at, you know, what, you know, because people are out there protesting the policy, right? But, you know, some of these guys are coming home, you know, missing their arms, missing their legs, you know, watching their teammates. Right. And then they come home to have their fellow countrymen, you know, spitting in their face and doing all this crazy stuff. And it was just, to me, I thought it was incredible how she felt so bad that she wanted to push him into doing something in that veteran space. And for her, it felt like a way of her kind of, you know, giving back and fixing what she felt like was a mistake in her past.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a good point. I think, you know, there's different, as we age and mature, I mean, you go through different periods of your life where you're extremely passionate. And, you know, for me in my 20s, when I was extremely passionate, I became a SEAL and wanted to go kill terrorists. You know, other people will become like, you know, rabid anti-war protesters. And, you know, you have your passions and you mature. And, you know, it really came full circle. Now I got to tell you a story. When I came back from my last deployment, I rotated back with Guy Buttonsack. He's an officer in my platoon. And him and I came back on the same bird, and we flew from Germany back to the States with a Army unit that had been deployed for a year. And, you know, we kind of hung in the back because, you know, it wasn't our show. And, you know, we normally fly to, you know, out to Coronado on the way back and not really catch a transport bird. But we landed at BWI, and, you know, we came off the ramp and walked into the terminal. And I'll never forget the amount of support that we got, which was 180 degrees from your buddy's experience in Vietnam. You know, we had people from World War II, Korea, you know, Gulf War, you know, recent Iraq or Afghanistan veterans welcoming us. But I will never forget, you know, what I saw in those Vietnam vets and, you know, the amount of support, you know, dudes with tears streaming down their face, you know, just giving us hugs and stuff. And they were just so proud of the response and, you know, what we had done. And I remember turning to a guy and saying, I was like, shit, man. I'm like, dude, those dudes endure the shit they had to so we could have this homecoming. And I think it, you know, it was one of the coolest experiences I had in the military because I got to see veterans, supporting other veterans, you know, have taken those licks so we could enjoy what we have today. And it was really powerful. And I think it, you know, goes to show you, you know, the sacrifices people have made before you to ensure the lifestyle that you have today.
Right. And I think, you know, especially for the, for that generation, I mean, those guys got a really raw deal. I mean, they fought a very tough war in a difficult environment, you know, a difficult terrain. And then, you know, to come home to that and you know, people talk, you hear the number of 22 veterans committing suicide a day, you know, and people raise awareness and do all these things. And that's great, you know, and people do this with good intentions. And this isn't a knock on people who are doing something that they feel like is right. But, you know, the truth is that the number is higher than 22. You know, there's discrepancies in the way they collect these numbers. And some places, the number of veterans committing suicide are not accounted for and that kind of thing. But another thing that people don't really talk about enough is that the majority of the veteran suicides that are taking place in America are Vietnam veterans. And, you know, these guys, you know, I've talked to different Vietnam guys who served in Vietnam, particularly in Special Forces, Green Berets. And, you know, I'll never forget this. And I've spoken about this on a podcast before. I'm friends with two of these guys on Facebook. And, you know, he posted some military video and they were kind of commenting back and forth with each other. And both of these guys served in MACV SOG in Vietnam. So a very elite unit running, you know, very dangerous operations behind enemy lines. And what they were saying to each other was that, you know, every night at a certain time, you know, he wakes up because he has these nightmares. And another thing he said was that it's gotten worse over time for him with old age, you know. And and I think a huge part of that, you know, the issue that guys have is the transition from, you know, being in a military unit, infantry unit, special ops, you know, you're going 100 miles an hour and then you're out and then your life is completely different. But, you know, with today's day and age, there are resources and people do support our troops, you know, and even if you're not around someone who you can talk to about it, you can go on social media and meet people, you know, you can have conversations, email, whatever it is. But during those days, they didn't have that. And a good friend of mine who comes on a podcast often, his name is Mike Stahl. He was a Green Beret in Vietnam. He had a cousin or a nephew who served in Vietnam in an infantry unit. And they both got out around the same time. And he said they never had one conversation about Vietnam. And that's just how it was. It was like taboo, you know. And I think not talking about it and keeping it bottled up for so many years is what is leading to some of those high suicide rates, you know, among these veterans.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct. You know, a good friend of mine, Jake Schick, you know, runs 22 Kill, and, you know, he's brought a lot of awareness to veteran suicides. And you're absolutely right. You know, the collection, the numbers, you know, and they have been hypothesized that they are higher than 22, and that's one too many. You know, one is one too many. And yeah. It boils down to communication. You know, I went into it, and I can speak just only for myself. You know, I went into it knowing very well that, you know, when I get to a SEAL team, because quitting was not an option. When I get to a SEAL team, you know, I will go to combat, and you know, there are chances that I might not make it back or friends of mine. And I told myself these are things that I'm willing to shoulder, not knowing if I would ever experience that. And I did. And, you know, for me, it's been more of a rational, you know, that is my experience. I volunteered for it, and those are the results. But I've been fortunate to communicate those, and I communicate, you know, we talk about it here, you know, with my friends, you know, when I go out and speak. And I think the more you're able to talk about that, the more you open up. You don't let your guard down. You don't become a pussy. You're still a tough guy, but, you know, you're able to share those experiences, and people can, you know, understand where you've come from. Because truth be told, if you've been MACV SOG or you've been a grunt in Afghanistan or in Iraq, you've been through some shit. And a lot of people are never going to understand where you've come from unless you tell them. And I think when you tell them, you know, you go ahead and educate them, which allows them to help you as you transition, you know, because you were very effective on your battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's go ahead and shift focus and find a new battlefield here, which you can make a difference. And I see it each and every day when I see veterans that are successful business owners. They go to school, they're working in healthcare, and it impresses me. And I think the more we communicate and tell people what we've been and done, the better it is for our transition and then also future generations that serve.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And then, you know, to add to that, it's also I like the way that a lot of these clubs have now started up, whether they be guys going out on bike rides, whether they be the We Defy, the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu side, you know, all of these different things that people are getting involved in. It's either, you know, it's like that club mentality, even for us. But, you know, over here that we have footy teams that, you know, you go and support. And it's that same kind of feeling where you feel like you're still part of that family, but you can start to, you know, you accept the stuff that you've experienced and you sort of use it to try and make you a better person. But right. And that's you use some sort of form of creativity. It doesn't have to be about writing everything. It could be creativity in other forms, you know, and other sorts of things. But I do think it's important that, you know, if you think about the Vietnam vets, the stuff that modern day soldiers could learn from those vets, you know, there should be, you know, potentially something. Their jungle warfare skills, there's so much there, isn't there, that they should always sort of be valued. Any sort of person that's gone before us should always be valued for what we can learn from them. And then obviously with that comes support. And, you know, like you say, you know, one's too many. There shouldn't be someone out there that feels that they get that low that they're going to take their own life. And I know even in, like, and this is just a thing, I think, across the board, that generally there's a certain age group in the UK of suicide attempts are more often happening by young men, and I don't know what that is. I don't know how that happens. I think it's through the years, you know, men have always been told to sort of keep shit in. And then, having said that, you don't want guys to then, like you said, Kevin, to turn into suddenly these over emotional beings that are kind of, you know, because it just, the dynamic would kind of go a bit strange. But there certainly has to be somewhere to meet in the middle. There's got to be, and I reckon maybe these groups are helping. You know, they're the groups that people can go to, veteran run. You're not necessarily put in front of a doctor and getting put on 1,000 meds. You know, so yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that I don't think is ever going to be perfect. But as long as I'd like to feel like we do our bit for those that have gone before us, then that's surely how the system works.
Right. You know, but, you know, the whole medication part of it. You know, it's a huge problem here in America, even outside of the veteran community. You know, people are addicted to these painkillers, you know, and it's really becoming a problem. But what kind of makes it worse is it's driven by profit. You know, it's a huge business. And, you know, these companies have their teeth, you know, in Congress. Politicians, you know, they bought them out, and it's really a problem. But a lot of veterans have talked about how they were like on a downward spiral, and, you know, they're on 10 different medications every day, on top of drinking and whatnot. And some of these guys, or most of them that I've heard stories from or talked to, is once they stopped taking those pills, that's when the process began of them healing, you know. And what's interesting about what Kevin is doing now is with his physician work, they do some really cool stuff with increasing performance, right, and some of that kind of thing. Kevin, can we talk about that?
Yeah. So I came down here and started working with Dr. Dave LeMay. And, you know, Dr. LeMay has worked in PMR, physical medicine rehabilitation, and has branched off recently, you know, in the last couple of years, of doing, you know, more of this A4M work, which is a more naturopathic way of looking at performance, you know, getting down to the details of cortisol and stress and how that affects your overall performance and sleep. And, you know, we in our clinic see a lot of veterans from the special operations community and beyond, who, you know, are turning towards this more natural approach, getting away from these medications, and are finding, you know, that not just the mental healing, but also, you know, the physical healing, because those opioids suppress for such a long period of time that eventually you're going to have to deal with those receptors. And we do. And, not everybody who comes in has PTSD. We have people that are broken from 20, 25 years on the job, who are trying to mend, who have been on Motrin for 20 years. And what we do is we look at a more natural approach. How can we get this person up to where they should be, you know, with basic nutrients, with basic supplements, and how to get them back to that performance level. Because once your body feels good, then your mind feels good. And we try and target that physiologic aspect.
How's it going? Is it going good? Are you seeing really good results?
Yeah, we've done well. We've teamed up with some really good docs around the country, and Dr. LeMay has been, he is a true, I call him a pioneer. He has opened my eyes on so many different levels with how to look at things, and his knowledge of pathophysiology and how things work down at the micro level has really opened my eyes to how many times we've given our veterans a raw deal by just putting them through a meat grinder and expecting good results all the time. And we develop very patient specific plans, and we follow the patient. It's a lot of time invested, but the results are there. And we get veterans and we get active duty guys who get off a lot of these medications, off these pain medications and sleep medications, and back to normal function.
And that's something that is the concept of that could be something that's looked at for even respite. So guys that are still operating at that sort of highest level, sometimes they, rather than wait until they burn out, maybe interject earlier on and say, right, you almost like enforced rest, get it done, and then they get back in. Potentially you could see off the problems occurring later. I don't know, that sort of thing. Because guys,
we do.
They burn out.
Yeah, so we do. We work with a lot of special operations groups at a bunch of different tier levels. And, and it's looking at, basic nutrition, micronutrients, hormones, your basic cholesterol, and going beyond that and getting a baseline and correcting a lot of these disease processes before they, become out of control or when they retire. And you're absolutely right. So when you get out, and John, you brought up earlier, you get out of the military, you transition, then you kind of like stall in the water. Same thing physiologically. We have guys that are, pushing through pain, breaking those thresholds and keeping going for 20 years, and then they stop, and then everything, all of a sudden, the car breaks down like a year later. And so we get guys early in their career to help, mitigate some of these disease processes. So when they get out, they're not broken down. They can still function and take that career and start a second career.
And that's another thing, that's the only thing that we were quite happy about. Sometimes I'm not a technophobe, but the way that things are moving forward, you'd wish they'd slow down. But in that area, that's a bit you want to speed up, because it's helping. And if you imagine if the way that we're thinking, and people like the doctor you're working with, if we had people like that back in the days of the Vietnam War or, the Falklands and things like that, it might have made a difference to those guys that are, are taking their lives.
I agree.
Yeah, the Falklands was rough. I mean, it wasn't a long conflict, but if I remember correctly, I think I read that more veterans from the UK military committed who served in the Falklands died by suicide than guys who were killed in combat.
Yeah, and I always put it down to a lot of the time, it's almost like the forgotten wars, isn't it? It's those ones that Vietnam was... Obviously, the hard left, wanted that not to happen. So the abuse that the veterans got, the Falklands was kind of quick, and then it was over with, and the country was going through other changes. So people kind of get like we've all but forgotten about Northern Ireland now. And it's the same sort of process. You kind of the world moves quickly, and they forget very quickly. It's weird.
Yeah.
Strange.
You're right.
Yeah. So Kevin, can you share a story with the audience? Maybe from a deployment or something that just stood out to you during your time in the service?
You got to give me a minute on that one.
if you pulled me off guard.
I thought I told that story earlier about coming back from Iraq. No, I mean, if you pick up The Last Punisher, there's tons of stories in there about that stood out enough for me to put them in a book. A lot of times, people always focus on the intensity of combat. And what I want to do with The Last Punisher was definitely show the low points where you're not doing as much as your friends think you are. It's like that meme where like what I do, what my friends think I do, what my mom thinks I do, what I'm actually doing. But we were out on the Syrian border in 2008, and it was not the intensity level that we experienced in 2006. I mean, my main trauma that I had to deal with is one of my guys in my platoon was operating a nail gun and shot a nail through his hand that we had to go ahead and pull out. but we used to, you know, we have a lot of fun with a lot of our technical support. So we, you know, one of our officers was like, man, we really got to fuck with these guys, the nerds, as we called them, the guys that were, you know, they pick up all the, you know, chatter on the radio waves and help, you know, find out where the bad guys were. And we'd rove around and stuff. And we planned an operation to go out, and you know, we got all the team guys were all on the same page. And we got the nerds in there for the brief. We totally played it off like it was a, you know, we're going to expect casualties somewhere. And they're like at least 50% casualties in this op, you know, just do the IEDs and the small arms fire and stuff. And by the time, you know, our platoon chief got up there and gave his fire and brimstone talk about, you know, how dangerous the area was, and our OIC gets up there and echoes the same sentiments, you know, we're jocking up, getting ready to roll out. And I'm like putting in extra magazines, and I got like frag grenades hanging off. And like, these nerds are like about to lose their shit. Like, I mean, they're like ghost face, like had never been in combat before, you know. They barely, you know, their rifles shaking in their hands. We take off, and it was like driving Miss Daisy. It was the easiest hop. And, you know, we went around, did our little deal, and came back. And these guys were literally shitting bricks the entire time. And, you know, and it's just fucking with guys, you know, when they go into combat. And I mean, that's what it's about. It's about, you know, not taking everything so damn seriously and, you know, having a good time. Because, shit, you know, you can only fight a war for so long in your physical lifetime. And you got to have some fun with it. And we had some fun with the turds, the nerds. I said turds. Freudian slip. On that 08 deployment. But it was a good time. Good times.
But even you laugh at just bringing that humor in. I was on, there was some sort of feed on Facebook not so long ago, and there were a lot of guys, spec op guys, and just people, different people chatting, and the banter was really, it was comedy. You know, people were just, that dark humor was coming out, and somebody came on and, you know, was absolutely disgusted at this. You know, they couldn't believe what they were reading, that they didn't know about any of the backgrounds of the people that were talking on this feed, and it was just like, wow. So I felt so, like, far removed, and thought, well, maybe it is us. Maybe we're the ones with the issues.
maybe we are weird.
Yeah, we're just weird. And then if it's not weird, then make it weird. You know, it's almost exactly. Like you can make it the weirdest or the most awkward.
The one quote I've always, you know, lived my team career with was the old Hunter S. Thompson: when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. And if you want to be a good team guy, you want to be a good operator, you want to be a good, you know, soldier, I mean, live by that phrase: when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro.
That's true, isn't it? You've got to be the sort of the weirdest at the table.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because even outside of, like, you know, military war fighting or tactics or, you know, strategy, military strategy, the lessons from these stories can be applied to life. And I think that's, you know, that's the reason why people would pay you, Kevin, to go and speak to their group or company or whatever it is. And even that short story you just told right there, you know, kind of the message of not taking yourself too seriously can really apply to your entire life, you know. And I mean, obviously you have to take yourself serious and take what you're doing serious, but to kind of, I think there's a quote, I forget who the hell wrote it, but it's to, you know, think lightly of yourself and deeply of the world, you know. And I think that's a lesson that can apply everywhere in life.
Yeah, you're right, man. And, you know, when I speak to people, I heard a, you know, a great SEAL admiral, you know, use this phrase. It was, you know, flash to bang. So, you know, to make sense of it, you know, when you see a lightning strike, you know, as a kid, you'd like count how many seconds till you heard the thunder rumble, kind of give you an idea of how far away from, you know, the actual lightning strike you are. And there's a time frame for everything. And, you know, when I got out of the Navy in 2010, you know, that flash to bang was pretty fast. I was just there. I just got out of combat, just finished my time in the teens. But I'm 7 years out of that. And that flash to bang, that count is going, and it's getting wider and wider. But the principles that I learned, you know, about myself, you know, the things I learned about myself in training, I still carry out to this day as, you know, a teammate in the practice. You know, and then how I, you know, just complacency kills, things like that are very applicable, although that flash to bang has been extended. And I think a lot of veterans who are listening, you know, it doesn't matter how long that flash, if you were in Vietnam to where you're at now, I mean, you learn things that a lot of people have never experienced because they've never been in combat. And you can always use that to your advantage. And I think you need to keep things in perspective. But you are an asset in any battlefield you go to because of the experiences you've had and done.
Yeah, and when in this sort of day and age, in the current climate, you know, those people are godsends, you know, and I hope they never have to use it. But I know that I'd rather be standing with someone like that who has, you know, has gumption. And you see, we see it even in our civilian sector. There are people out there that, you know, are prepared to go above and beyond what's really expected of them. And that's, I think that's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing.
Agreed.
There's another long, awkward silence. Fuck.
I love those, to be honest.
You're such an asshole, John.
It's levity. I like it.
Leaves you hanging.
So Kevin, if anybody wants to keep up with you and maybe get their hands on a copy of your book, what's the best place that they can do that?
Sure. You can go to www.kevinlace.com. I've got links from there to books, shirts, coins, also links to our charity, Hunting for Healing. Our website is huntingforhealing.org. And you can pick up a copy of The Last Punisher at Barnes & Noble's, Books a Million, online, Amazon. And we've also we've released in Spanish. We've released in German. And I think that's it for right now. But we have Czech and Czech's coming out next. So I'll keep you abreast. But if you go to www.kevinlace.com, you can find all that information out.
Hey, you know, actually, I'm glad you mentioned the Hunting for Healing because I completely forgot to ask you about that. Can we talk about that quickly before we get out of here?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, as I mentioned last time, Hunting for Healing, it really began when my wife, Lindsay, and I were hunting in Africa in 2015. We were just putting pen to paper, working on The Last Punisher. And I've been to Africa 2 years prior to that hunting and enjoyed it. And I wanted to bring my wife out there because aesthetically, Africa is beautiful. People are amazing. And how you get to shoot big animals. So I took Lindsay out there, and she's from a hunting family, but had never hunted for herself. And was always wondering, like, what do you do when you go hunting? And she saw it. It's about deer camp. It's about the stories. It's about the hunt. And then it's about the process afterwards. So, you know, she launched Hunting for Healing, which is a 501c3 out of Florida. And the mission is to take injured veterans and their spouses on hunting, fishing, outdoor activities to brand, intensify that communication between the relationship. And we've been on a bunch of different trips. We were in Africa at the beginning of May, and we took a former ranger who lost both his legs below the knee and his wife. And then we took a former and recently retired Air Force EOD guy and his wife. And took them out there, and we had a hell of an experience. We did the hunt, hunted 7 days in Namibia, Plains Antelope, and we got to give back to the community. You know, a lot of people focus on hunting as just shooting animals, and those people have no idea what hunting is when they say that. And what we did was we got to shoot some animals and take the meat to the local villages and got to, you know, meet a lot of the people and play some soccer and really bring everything full circle. And it was great to see American servicemen and women, you know, giving back to the communities through the hunt. So we're full bore ahead with Hunting for Healing, and we got a couple trips up in the future. And if you know anybody who is interested, or you want to nominate somebody, go to www.huntingforhealing.org. I know we've got an archery hunt in Ohio coming up. We've got Costa Rica coming up again in the spring, and a bunch more hunts. So go check it out for information.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a brilliant. What a brilliant thing. And actually really, really cool that your wife started that. That's really cool.
Yeah, she's, you know, she is a definite Spartan woman, and you know, it was her passion project. She's her father was in the Navy for 30 some odd years. You know, and he was a naval attaché to Denmark, and she's moved a bunch, you know, with the Navy, and you know, has always been supportive of the military. And then when her and I met, you know, she got immersed in the SEAL culture, and you know, a lot of our mutual friends are team guys and their wives. And, you know, having worked on Sniper and, you know, doing what we do now, it fueled her to give back. And, she looks at it from the spouse perspective, because I think that's, you know, that, as you know, it's the toughest job in the military. And, a lot of guys see hunting as an outlet to get away from the spouse. And I think, you know, if you can make that bond stronger, and we try to by getting people off the grid, you know, they can understand why you hunt and why you like to. And also, on a side note, you know, it's cool to like, for, you know, one of the couples we took, they'd been married for 17 years and they'd never been on a honeymoon together, never been on a vacation together. And she had never seen him, you know, train or shoot or any of that stuff. So it was cool to watch, you know, Chris, you know, train his wife, Lauren, how to shoot. And, it's awesome to get that vet back into his wheelhouse and, you know, back to that operator status.
And also, again, in the current climate, with the women that get involved in those things, they have that feeling of they can actually protect themselves. And there's no better feeling of being empowered, you know, by being given the knowledge and the tools to protect yourself. I think that's a really good thing.
Yep.
Right, so I've got one last question. It's a yes or no answer, Kevin. It's a bit of a joke, so you've got to answer it honestly. Have you ever said to anyone, I was in Baghdad when you were in your dad's bag? Yes or no?
No, but I'm going to have to use that, though. That's great.
Someone asked me to ask you that, so I had to get there at the end.
That's perfect. I'm going to use that, though.
Yeah, it's hilarious. All right. Well, it was really great having you on, man.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, Chantel. John, thank you so much. It's been awesome.
And take care. Stay safe.
Likewise, you too.
And with that, we'll close out for this week's podcast. Before we go, I just want to say today is the 12th anniversary of the Operation Red Wings, in which U.S. Navy SEALs, initially four SEALs, went into Afghanistan, into a region of Afghanistan, and were tasked with special reconnaissance, surveillance, and they were discovered, they were ambushed, and three of the SEALs were killed. Lieutenant Michael Murphy was the team leader. As you heard in the introduction, the citation by President George W. Bush, he stepped in. He knew the only way that they would have any chance of survival was if they were able to communicate with the base. So he stepped into a clearing, got on the phone, got in contact with the base, let them know what was happening. He had no cover, and he was able to let them know. They sent a quick reaction force to come and try and get these guys, and he was killed as he was hanging up the phone. The quick reaction force helicopter was shot down, killing everybody on board. And at the time, this was the worst loss of life in Afghanistan and the worst loss of life for naval special warfare for a very long time. Marcus Luttrell was the only survivor of this incident. And I just want to, you know, remember this, as it's important to remember these men who made the ultimate sacrifice in service for our country. And with that, we'll close it out. My website is globalrecon.net. My Facebook account is FB Recon. My Instagram account is IG Recon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. The third account is Chantel Taylor's military account. It's Mission_Critical. I'm on there from time to time. You can check us out on LinkedIn, search Global Recon, on Twitter, IG Recon. Be sure to subscribe, like, and download and share these episodes with your friends and family. And that way, we will continue to bring you guys good quality content week after week. We have some really good episodes lined up for you guys over the next couple of weeks. And we hope you enjoy it. Peace.